thank you all for joining us today. We're really excited. Just so you know, we sold out, and some of you are coming off the wait list. Our wait list was 50 people long for about 10 seats. And we are very glad that you could be here. And we just had no idea that Ramen actually would be this huge of a topic. We originally booked, you know, actually a smaller room, so I'm glad we came up to this larger room. And lots to talk about, so I'm not going to linger too much in my introduction, except just to point you to the program. There are bios, complete bios in there for Andy and for George. Unfortunately, Eric Nakamura from Giant Robot, we've learned yesterday, is unable to join us. So, but we have the two of them, and they've had so many years and so much travel that we'll be lucky to even not run over our time tonight. We do want to leave a lot of time for Q&A from you. So in about 10 minutes, we may have sound, or we may not. But hopefully, you can all hear us in the meantime. So Andy, journalist based here in the Bay Area, a friend and colleague of mine, and author of the book that just came out last month, Ramen King and I, and George Solt, who is associate professor at New York University and teaches in the history department, and has wonderful research on the role of wheat as well as ramen in Japan. So I wanted to start off first and ask the two of you just to kind of give us a sense of, first of all, before we get into the history and the economics of it, your personal relationship with ramen. And so if you could share with us maybe some early memories and then your first time eating ramen and then how maybe that has changed through time.
So I'm going to start?
Okay. Sure.
Hi, I'm Andy Rafkin, so I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, until I was around 12. We moved to Long Island, so basically New York. And my first experience with ramen, so I'm in my, mid-40s now. And so my first experience with ramen was in the 70s when I was a kid. And I didn't even know it was instant ramen because there were these ads on TV for this thing called Oodles of Noodles. And one day my mother brings this home, and it was a thing you could, they made a big deal, you could make it quickly and just add the water, and I don't remember it that well, except that there was somehow this excitement around these noodles, and actually still, that was Top Ramen, that was the original ramen when Nissin began marketing it in the U.S., they called it Oodles of Noodles, and still if you look on the Top Ramen package, as a sub-brand, it still says Oodles of Noodles under the Top Ramen. That was probably my first experience, and then later when I started studying in Japan, I studied Japanese at a college called the ICU, International Christian University, which you don't have to be Christian to go to. It's not, actually, I think the undergrads have to take Christian classes, but it's a very popular place for Americans to do like a year abroad in Japan and study Japanese. And at that time, so even until like the mid-90s, you could not, the ATM machines at Japanese banks were closed outside of the bank hours, which is sort of ridiculous, you know? What's an ATM for, really, other than, you know, you want it outside. But anyway, I would often forget this. I was already used to going to ATMs in the States, you know, and so I'd forget to get the money on the weekend at like Friday, 5 o'clock. And so I'd have like $3 in my pocket, you know, the equivalent of, yeah, and so I'd be thanking God for instant ramen those weekends.
For me, my first exposure to ramen wasn't really instant ramen, I guess. I was born in Japan and lived there till I was 10 years old. And for me, it was the local pushcart pusher who made ramen at nighttime between 7 p.m. and 3 a.m., actually. So I'd go around 7 p.m. when my mom would still let me. But the man, he was basically a reformed yakuza of some point. He was missing he was missing a pinky, he had a shaved head. And he'd tell us a lot of stories about the neighborhood that I didn't learn from my family, that I didn't learn from school. So he was kind of a local historian of the underground, in a sense. I don't know, that's the way I interpreted him. And I really got into going to his little noodle stand and just hearing stories about the neighborhood. So for me, it was food, plus culture, really, and that's how I got interested in pursuing ramen as a subject of study later on. But that was my first exposure to ramen. And it was ninnikuran, it was garlic ramen, so I'd always carry around the smell of this ramen for a couple of days after I ate it, but that was about it.
Well, I grew up with it when my mom and I came here in the late 70s. And I remember her, I was really little, and she would make it, and she would actually break it in half. You know, this is, I mean, that's like those stories, like, we were so poor, we broke our ramen in half, you know. but I remember, I have really fond memories of instant ramen, at least, because it was a time that I shared with my mom. My mom worked late at nights, and she'd come home, and it would be the time that the two of us would, you know, literally share a packet of ramen. I actually was one of the few people who didn't eat it much in school. And then later I discovered, you know, hand-pulled ramen, and that was just a completely different experience. And we're going to try and kind of touch on both. They're different animals, and I'm just wondering, like, if the two of you wanted to touch on that yourself, like, if you have a working definition of ramen, and then maybe, like, real ramen or fake ramen, if there is, or, you know, like what's your approach to that? Let's just, like, get it out of the way.
I study basically real ramen. I don't want to call it real ramen. Everything's real. But, you know, my main focus of my dissertation, which I just finished, is real ramen and how it shifts over time, over a century in Japan, how it changes name, how the symbolism changes, how it gets associated with different groups, how it's consumed differently. So I do look a little bit about instant ramen, but it's mainly just the real ramen and how it changes and how it teaches us a lot about economic changes and social changes in Japan if we take a careful look at it.
And for those of us who maybe haven't broken down what that means, how would you describe to someone who's never ever eaten, like, an alien that comes to the U.S. What is ramen?
It's wheat flour based noodles in a meat broth soup, and the meat broth is what differentiates it from previous noodle soups in Japan that had existed traditionally or historically, and also the alkali, which is part of the noodle, gives it a bit of a stench and a yellowish hue, which again, distinguishes it from other noodles that have been in Japan until the 1880s. So the two key things that separate ramen from other noodle soups in Japan are that the alkali in the noodles and the meat for the broth in the soup.
Why do they add alkali, do you know?
Oh, because the people who brought it from China lived in a certain part of China where alkali was highly concentrated in the rivers where they were. So when they made noodles, it just had a high alkali content naturally. But in Japan, they had to make it a chemical additive.
I see.
I think it gives the noodles what Japanese call koshi, which is like a kind of like al dente kind of bite, and also that yellowish flavor too.
You want to speak about the meat broth, and this is a good time to talk about some of that history.
So wheat flour had been used for noodles in Japan for a few centuries before ramen had arrived, and it had been consumed mainly as a somen, udon, or a kishimen, which were the three main forms of wheat flour-based noodles. But they were all consumed in soups that were mainly fish broth-based. So the big difference between Chinese noodle soup in Japan and the previous kinds were basically the meat that was used in the broth of the soup. And the reason that meat had been absent from soup broths in Japan until that point was basically the Buddhist, prohibition, thank you, against meat consumption. So it wasn't completely ubiquitous, but most Japanese avoided meat consumption because of Buddhism until the late 1800s when European imperialism and new ways of thinking about food really changed the dietary practices in Japan.
I think also that was the time when the Chinese started coming in. The Meiji Reformation opened the country to a lot of Chinese immigrants. The Yokohama Chinatown formed, and so you got all these, you know, and that's where really the ramen, would you say, it began, in those Chinese Chinatowns, right?
Absolutely,
yeah.
And those are being eaten mainly by the Chinese who were living in that area. Were Japanese eating at that point?
No, so initially it was mainly consumed by Chinese workers and students, because there were a lot of Chinese students in Japan who were trying to study modernization in the late 1800s. So in that period, it was known as Nankin Soba, because it was associated with the Chinatown district of Yokohama, which was known as Nankin Machi, or Nanjing Town, to be literal. So basically it was known as Nankin Soba, which was, soba is the Japanese word for noodles, and it was associated with that part of Yokohama. And it was consumed mainly by Chinese until about the 1910s. That's when it shifts into Japanese industrial working class neighborhoods, and it starts being produced by Japanese chefs as well. And the name changes as well in that period. It becomes Shina Soba from Nankin Soba as the image of China changes in a Japanese popular understanding. So it's very tightly connected with shifting images of China, with migration flows in the late 19th century, and also changing understandings of nutrition as well, because until that point, meat was not considered something healthy or nutritious or something you would really want to consume. And after the Europeans arrived, then meat consumption and also wheat flour-based foods become much more heavily consumed.
I'm just going to, I see our sound people walking. Are they walking away? Walking away. Okay. Actually, while I've interrupted, excuse me just a moment. If you have an empty chair next to you, could you raise your hand, please? Because we do have people standing in the back. So those of you who are standing in the back, please feel free to come up and take seats. I'll just do the disruption now and not do that again. And we may have people, I apologize, we have people coming late, too. They may be trickling in. Did you have anything to add to that? Actually, before I come to you about that, can you talk a little bit more? You mentioned shifting images of Chinese. Can you, a little bit more detail about that?
Yeah, so first of all, European food came in the 1860s and 70s and began being consumed by the elites. So the elite Japanese really took to European food, and this was pretty early on. It took another 50 years or so for Japanese to really embrace Chinese food. And the period they did in the 1910s and 20s, it was done so because the Japanese military began promoting Chinese foods as a very nutritious, healthy alternative to European foods, which were not as widely available. So Chinese food became kind of a cross between the healthy ingredients of European foods and the soy sauce and the rice and the chopstick and, you know, the customs of Japanese food. So the Japanese military began promoting Chinese food as something healthy and nutritious and also affordable for the working masses in the 20s. So in the 10s, you start seeing the first Japanese ramen shops in the working class neighborhoods run by people who had been working in Yokohama, actually. So who had some exposure to the Chinese cuisine of that time and who bring it to the Japanese neighborhoods. And yeah, that's when the name begins to change and the popularity of the food among Japanese starts to take off. So that's really, and also the image of China, sorry, I just missed the question completely. So the image of China is changing at the same time. It begins in the Meiji period. China is obviously the teacher of all things of high culture, and so things that come from China are revered, and not just the food, but the calligraphy, the arts, and so on. And China has a very important position in teaching Japan cultural aspects. But later on, as the Europeans start to dominate Japanese politics and imperialism becomes much more heightened, basically the image of China changes and deteriorates. So that's when the name of the dish shifts from Nankin Soba to Shina Soba. But the image of China in Japanese politics is shifting as well. It shifts from Chugoku, or the Middle Kingdom as it was known, to where it's Shina. And Shina is a Japanese colonial term for China, which was basically rejected by the Chinese government in bilateral negotiations throughout Japan's colonial period. So until the post-war period, it was understood as Shina Soba, and it was associated with kind of a stagnant China, which had been defeated in the Sino-Japanese War, and which was no longer a teacher of high culture, but basically a supplier of cheaper foods, I guess. Mm-hmm.
So it was just seen as kind of cheap, similar to what we see at instant ramen now.
Right.
So cheap ramen.
Yeah.
I saw you nodding early, Andy. Did you anything you wanted to add to that? Or?
This word Shina is kind of a taboo word now. The first actual ramen shop, the first place, so there had been stands and there had been these places, it had been on the menus in Chinese restaurants in Chinatowns. The first one is called Daidaiken, which actually there's a place in New York in East Village called Dai Dai Ken, which is sort of named after it, I would assume. And this was in 1910, and they called it Shina Soba. And so I came to ramen partly in a totally different way in my later life, which was about my love life. I started to pray to the inventor of instant ramen for help and guidance in my love life. That's the story in my book, but we're not going to talk too much about my love life tonight, I don't think. But one of the things I found along my journey is this comic book. This is book 16 of Ramen Discovery Legend. And the story is basically there's this guy, Fujimoto, and he works like during the day, he wears a suit and he goes to this regular suit job. And his secret desire is to quit his job and open a ramen stand. And at night in the park, even though it's against the company rules, he runs a little stand in the park to kind of learn his craft. And his secretary, Ms. Sakura, is the only one who knows his secret ramen identity. Anyway, there's a whole episode in one of these where he goes to this ramen shop that's still calling its stuff Shina Soba. And he goes with some Chinese visitors from his company, and they're really offended by this name. And he tells the ramen shop owners, they're like, what are you talking about? It's just an old name for China. And he has to explain, you know, that it has these implications and that it's sort of politically incorrect to do that.
And one thing I want to note is that there's been a resurgence in shops that call themselves Shina Soba shops or that specialize in Shina Soba, in the last 10 years. And this has also occurred alongside, you know, right-wing politicians reintroducing this term as normal, as natural, as okay. So, again, the image of China and the words used for ramen and the way they're treated in popular culture really has a lot to do with bigger issues in politics, too. It's not just the food itself.
So when did the term, is it chuka soba or chuka, can you talk about that term then? And maybe some of the, or maybe I'm jumping the gun. Is that later we shouldn't...
Why don't you do it?
Oh, yeah. So the shift from Shina Soba to Chuka Soba happens right after the Second World War. And in major newspapers in Japan, you see a shift away from calling China Shina to calling China Chugoku, again, the Middle Kingdom. So as the word for China shifts back to Chugoku in mainstream Japanese politics, we find the mainstream designation for the food being a Chuka Soba instead of Shina Soba. And this was a way to kind of move away from these terms associated with Japanese imperialism and try to remake Japan as a non-imperialist country in the post-war period by using words that would not be associated with this darker past. So that's when Chuka Soba becomes the main term for the dish. And for a short period after the Second World War, Chuka Soba was the main term until it became ramen. And
We'll hold off on that. I think we're still kind of in this interwar post-war period. Uh-huh. And before we go to Momofuku Ando, which is key in our discussion tonight, the inventor of instant ramen. I want to set a little bit more of the context in out of which he sprung. So if you could talk a little bit more about what was happening in Japan then. We talked about linguistically around the noodle, but let's talk about the economy, the culturally, what's the environment?
You mean for instant ramen?
Yes. Why don't we, I'll leave it to you to decide when you want to talk about which ramen.
Why don't you talk about
you
the flour stuff?
By the way,
meeting George is, like, so incredible for me because, like, I thought I was the only, it's kind of like when you're a kid, like, you know, you're into some, like, thing that you think nobody else is into. And, like, you know, like, you've read comic books or something or you've watched some TV show that nobody else, and, like, oh, yeah, remember that time Momofuku Ando wrote that book? And we said, oh, yeah, I remember that. So one of the things we were talking about was how Momofuku Ando is the inventor of instant ramen, and one of the things he wrote a lot about was how this was about maybe 10 years before he invented instant, before he basically built this shack in his backyard and spent a year in it trying to invent the instant version. But before he did that, he once went to one of the ministers of nutrition at the health and welfare ministry, and he said, you know, then there's this whole thing about the ministry was pushing flour because the U.S. had a surplus. So the occupation forces, through the occupation forces, they're basically pushing the U.S. surplus of wheat. And he said, and because of that, the ministry was pushing bread on kids and all this kind of, and Ando was like, why don't we do noodles instead? Because those are like more Asian already. We don't have to teach people like a new, whole new way of eating with bread. And I never looked into that, but George actually looked into that. And I was wondering, like, was that really true? Was there evidence that they were pushing it? So I asked him, and maybe he can take
some.
Oh,
boy, can he give you evidence?
I wrote a long chapter about how U.S. wheat flour made its way into Japanese diets through basically Cold War policy of the U.S. to try to reindustrialize the economies of its Cold War allies and direct surplus wheat flour to those economies. So Japan, Korea, Taiwan as well, but also Germany and Cold War allies basically got a lot of U.S. wheat flour for really cheap, and that had a drastic effect on changing Japanese dietary habits in the post-war period. So as Andy was saying, there was all this wheat flour coming in from the U.S., and the government officials were at a loss of how to really absorb this into the Japanese food economy. So Ando Momofuku, being the kind of creative inventor that he was, figured out that, you know, noodles was the best way to do it. So his idea initially, written in the book, was that he would try to introduce noodles to the school lunch program because school lunches were a major source for absorbing all this wheat flour, and it came in the form of bread and biscuits and things as well. But eventually, the commercialization of instant noodles was the main form that all the surplus wheat flour took. But if you trace it back to kind of the Office of Developmental Assistance and look at U.S. policies around this time, which countries it was aiding, and what the rationale behind that was, it was clear that this was part of U.S. Cold War policy just to get Japan to agree to rearm some of its military forces, as was happening in the 50s. The U.S. Sorry, I'm getting lost in the details here, but the U.S. government really wanted to encourage the Japanese government to rearm after imposing kind of a pacifist constitution. And part of the agreements to get Japan to agree to rearm, which it was very reluctant to do, was this offering of cheap wheat flour. So basically, I think $60 million worth of wheat flour initially was shipped to Japan as Japan agreed to rearm some of its military. And so the way to get Japan to rearm, even though it was very reluctant, part of it was the surplus wheat flour, which eventually took the form of instant ramen. So anyway, it's connected to big, big political issues.
And there were severe food shortages, even right after the war, even during the Allied occupation. And I don't know if you want to just touch briefly on how hungry people... I mean, we have also, the U.S., gone through times of short food shortages, and I think we've forgotten that, you know, and to our... For good and bad, we have too much food now. But there was not too long ago, a mere decades ago, where there was definitely not too much food. And I want to make sure that we understand that clearly before we move forward into the instant.
Yeah,
moment.
Especially right after World War II. So Ando had been like the richest man in Japan. He's originally Taiwanese, but he came to Japan when he was 20 years old in 1930 and built a lot of businesses that supplied the war effort. Some industrial, some real estate businesses, things like this. And he, right after the war, he went back to Osaka, which had been really heavily bombed in the months just leading to the end of the war. And he goes there and he sees this devastation. All of his companies are destroyed. His real estate is gone. And on one of these trips, he sees this long line. This is part of the legend of the invention of instant ramen. He sees this long line of people starving, shivering, tattered, you know, clothes, behind Umeda Station, one of the big train stations in Osaka. And he stops and says, what are they waiting for? And he finds out that this little stall they're waiting for serves ramen, bowls of ramen. And when he died, so Ando died a couple of years ago, and a lot of articles make it sound like then he went and invented instant ramen. That was actually around over 10 years before he would actually build the shack in his house and invent it. But he always claimed that this line of people waiting showed him what the world wanted from him. and that when he eventually, 13 years later, he loses everything. He loses all his money. He's totally penniless. All he has is his home. He goes back to this thought, and that's why he starts the instant ramen. So it is very much related to the hunger.
And there's the Instant Ramen Museum in Osaka, I think on the site where he invented the thing. And if you walk around, there's flat-screen TVs showing footage of these long lines of people in front of the ramen cart right after the war. So it's part of the museum's history, and it's documented there.
What a segue. So this is the catalog to the Instant Ramen Invention Museum.
You can't tell, but Andy has a whole, he's got lots of show and tell here. So.
I think I'll stand up just because it's maybe hard to see it. I'll just show you a few things from here that I really like. So this is the story, really the story of the invention of instant ramen that we're leading to. So this is Momofuku Ando. So his family name is Ando. His given name is Momofuku. George has been saying Ando Momofuku, because that's the Japanese way to say it. The English way to say Momofuku Ando. I'll just say the English way. That's him. I don't know if you can see this. He's kind of invented. This is, so he also invented, in addition to the noodles, he invented the cup noodle, the actual cup. And what I love is he's kind of bending over a microscope here as if this invention required being like a chemist or something like that. The facade of the museum is like, this doesn't really capture it, it's a huge glass facade. It could easily be like the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. It's really quite elaborate. And in the center of it is this shack, which I mentioned. The shack, he was a head official at a bank that made a lot of bad loans. And the investors, which we know about now, right? The investors went after him personally, the depositors, to get their money back. And that left him with nothing except his house. And so again, he remembers back to this vision of the hut. He remembers back to the conversation he had with the person at the ministry about why can't we use the flour for noodles instead of bread. And he decides to build this shack in his backyard, fill it with cooking equipment, and basically spend morning till night in there until he invents an instant version of ramen. And it takes him, that he goes in 1957, he invents it in 58, and it goes on sale on August 25th, 1958. One of the great things about the museum is this, there's a timeline that goes all around the walls of the museum. And it starts, again, this is going to be a little bit hard to see, with these kind of short lines on one of the walls. And these lines represent, each line represents noodle developments in one part of the world. So it starts with, around, on this side, of the birth of Jesus Christ. And it goes all the way up to, it goes up to what it calls modern times. And so there's like the ancestor of macaroni is here, lasagna type products is here, soba, the Japanese ondudon. And they all lead, on one of the walls, they all lead to this huge bullseye in 1958 with chicken ramen, which was his first invention. And then it goes on for walls and walls, here's pages, of all the ramen brand extensions that his company, Nissin, made after that. Keeps going on.
Wow.
And again, in the place, it's all around the walls.
How much time did you spend in there?
Oh, you know, for me, I was in there for hours. But it's really fun. You can go and you can make your own instant ramen. You can, there's now, they renovated a couple of years ago, so that they have the cup noodle factory. You can go in and make your own cup and assemble your own ingredients to make your own personalized cup of noodle thing. This is another favorite. There's one wall. They put ramen developments in context with other major things that happen in the world. So see Neil Armstrong steps on the moon. This is the 60s to early 70s. The Beatles play a concert in Japan. And Momofuku Ando served a tin of Royal Hawaiian macadamia nuts on a flight back from the U.S. And he realized that the tinfoil on this top of the cup could be the top of a revolutionary new package design in which the noodles could be cooked, you know, shipped, and eaten. Cup noodles, the cup.
So can you talk about the instant part of the ramen? What was he doing back in that shack?
So there were many challenges to create an instant version of ramen that could be mass produced. The biggest was how to dry the noodles so that when he added the water, they would taste good and have the right consistency. He tried air drying them. He tried lots of different ways in the sun. Eventually, the legend goes that he saw his wife making some tempura. And he noticed that the when you fry something, these little holes develop and it gets kind of hard and dry. So he tried it with the noodles, and sure enough, they became highly absorbent. And most instant ramen is made that way until the more recent, healthier versions were developed. But that's the way most instant ramen is. And that was his major innovation. Just one more page that I just love from this book. This is the page of his birth.
Oh, yes.
So it says 1910 there, which by coincidence is the same year of that first ramen shop at Icahn. So the same year that he was born, Halley's Comet came to the Earth. And so Halley's Comet comes, you may know, every 75 or 76 years. And Niffen has always made a really big deal about this connection, essentially implying that Ando was sent from the heavens, and maybe even instant ramen itself is from above. You know? And you see it, you see this Halley's Comet icon. So again, George and I are like, this is great. Like, no one else has read this book except for, you know, him. But this is the icon. This is a book Ando wrote called How to Escape from Difficulty, which was personally helpful for me in my love life, believe it or not. But again, the Halley's Comet, this is the Halley's Comet logo. I went to his funeral. Well, we'll talk about that more. But again, Halley's Comet was the theme.
Before we'll come back to you, George. Just so you talk a little bit about the technology of the package ramen. I love the example or the challenges we have. We completely take for granted that cup noodle or cup O noodle, and then they drop the O later, so it's now cup noodle. As far as, you know, it's not as simple as we think it is putting one of those together. Can you talk a little bit about the noodles and the noodle pillow?
Well, I can talk a little bit about it, but it's all in this. So this is in Japan. There's a TV show on TV series called Project X, and they do these like incredible documentaries about inventions. Like there's one about the liquid crystal display, or there's one about the first cheap calculator. You know, and they're like they're so dramatic and they're great. Like if you're all into like product innovation and stuff. Anyway, they did one about cup of noodle. And it became a comic book, and then the comic book was translated into English. So this is one of the few English things about the whole story. And it's this incredibly dramatic, like there's a whole chapter about how they had to, this guy had to go around the world looking for the right shrimp. Because the regular shrimp they used, when they dried it, when they dehydrated it, it wasn't red. It didn't say red. So they had to find a version, and they found one somewhere, I don't know, like Vietnam or somewhere, where it stayed red. And this is a really fun comic book. But yeah, basically there were a lot of he got the idea for the cup. The macadamia nuts gave him the idea for the top. But on that same trip, this is in 1966. He goes comes to the U.S. to try to market instant ramen to the U.S. supermarket execs, and he shows it to them. He gives it to them, and they break it up and put it into styrofoam coffee cups, which he's never. Usually in Japanese, they would eat it out of a bowl. And they eat it with a fork. And he's just, like, amazed. And then he realizes, oh, my God, like, that could be new. So he gets the idea for a cup of noodles. There were several challenges. The biggest one was what shape the noodle thing should be and what shape the cup should be. If you notice, it's sloped inward. This is the new eco version of the cup that I got at his funeral. it's sloped inwards so that the noodle stuff, basically, the noodles are made so that it's not a cylinder. The sides slope in like the cup so that it doesn't turn over and so that there can be some space on the bottom so that the hot water can get under there and cook all of the noodles. So the whole design of it, again, this is like three chapters in here just to make the size of the cup. Also, they found that there's this whole other story about how the cylinder would tilt during the production, and so they didn't know how to solve that. And then Ando had a dream where he was, they have this, this is in some of the, he has this dream where he's floating down, upside down, and the cup is falling with him. And when he wakes up, he realizes, oh my God, we should make it upside down and have the cup come over it, and somehow that fixed this problem. I don't really understand how, but that fixed the problem. So this whole dream that he had is part of it, is part of the legend as well of the cup noodle, and I love that.
Yeah. Lots of stories around them, and they sort of edified them. So I kind of want to get now maybe a little bit more into the post-war period.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can talk to us a little bit more about maybe the different groups who eat ramen and some of the identity that that springs out of it circumstantially, but maybe also what may have been crafted intentionally and or not.
Yeah, I tend to see it as circumstantial, but mm-hmm. basically ramen was the cheap kind of, and it was considered very nutritious in the early post-war period because it was very filling and because of the meat and also the wheat flour was considered more nutritious than rice. There was a lot of promotion of the nutritiousness of wheat flour in that time. And also the instant chicken ramen was sold as something with vitamin nutrients and kind of essential healthful benefits for mothers feeding their children. So anyway, this was promoted as a health food initially, and it was that's the instant version. But also the regular version was consumed by industrial workers mainly as stamina food, and it was supposed to keep them going through a long work day at the construction site or some kind of hard manual labor. So because this was the cheapest food available to the working masses generally, it became symbolically associated with kind of blue-collar masculine work in the post-war period. And so later on, when it becomes elevated as kind of a Japanese national iconic food, that symbolism carries it a long way because it has already in it this imagery of high growth, reindustrialization of the economy, and the fuel for that, basically. So this became, in a sense, the chief fuel for the reindustrialization of Japan in the early post-war period. And even today, is a very kind of masculine and very tough guy association with eating ramen, and it's almost seen as the anti-gourmet food. So gourmet foods are usually seen as the French or Italian cuisines in Japan, which are very advanced, and people study for years in France and Italy to become serious chefs over there. But ramen kind of takes the opposite of that. If you love ramen, then you're a real kind of, you're a real man who doesn't go for the French food and the Italian food. And you know who you really are, and you know who your roots are, kind of. So that's all the result, I think, of the early post-war period and the political function it served as kind of a emergency food for industrial workers.
You mentioned the Yakuza guy was your introduction. There still is, I think, a little bit of association of ramen shops with kind of tough guys, and even some ex-cons that ramen shops are sort of havens for ex-cons to gain employment. So they're a little bit of a rough culture there.
Mm-hmm. Now even.
Now even.
Yeah. And it's very romanticized in a sense, too. So in magazines, you'll see articles saying, are you a salaried employee at a large corporation who's miserable, frustrated with your life? You know, the answer to your problems may be opening up a ramen shop.
Yeah. So the guy's dream is, what in Japanese, dasara. So, datsu means to get out of, and sara is the beginning of, as George says, salary man. So his dream is to dasara, like to leave salaried life and to open up a ramen shop and become his own man. Yeah, exactly.
So, but the industrialization, does that then mean that ramen was a city food, an urban food?
Definitely. So it's definitely an urban food, and it's basically associated with Tokyo mostly, because even in the Kansai region, you have Osaka, The wheat flour was consumed largely as okonomiyaki pancakes, and udon is very popular on Kansai region too. So if you go to Western Japan, people are much more excited about their favorite pancake shop and their affinity for udon noodle soup. And in Tokyo, and also kind of the newer cities of Japan, so Sapporo to the north, and Yokohama obviously near Tokyo, these are the cities where ramen is the most popular, and it's basically the modern urban industrial food, and that's the symbolism it takes on, especially in the post-war period. It becomes more so, I think.
So you mentioned about the regional food. You want to? Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you want to say about this period? Sort of, we can move on to the economic growth of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and
right.
how does that changing context then change ramen too?
So there's a lot of things going on, but during the 60s and 70s, I think you can generally say that Japanese diets became more homogenized. Generally, throughout the country, people were consuming more similar foods, and that's because the large amount of wheat flour, but also there was a standardized image of a normal Japanese diet that became very widespread in the 60s and 70s as a result of basically high-speed economics and generally the homogenization of kind of urban consumer culture in general, which goes along with a nuclear family replacing the old traditional family and so on. So there's all these social factors that are coming together. And basically the result is that ramen consumption takes off in the 60s and 70s because it's the fuel of industrial work. But after that phase of kind of homogenizing dietary influences and post-high economic growth, so the high economic growth period comes to a halt in the early 70s. And from the early 70s on, ramen gets reconfigured more as a regional specialty. And that's also connected to efforts to promote regional tourism in Japan on the part of the government. So cities like Hitakata and Hakata and also Sapporo became very famous for their special ramen, which was distinct from other cities' ramen. And people would actually travel across the country on tour groups and line up for hours in front of these specialty ramen shops, which represented the very distinct local regional flavor. And the way I analyze it, I see it as all connected to efforts to promote regional tourism in Japan and government efforts to stimulate domestic economic demand rather than export-led growth and so on. But anyway, I'm getting kind of
so
carried
do you,
away here.
Do you have a favorite style or region that you personally prefer?
I spent about a year as a management consultant living in Fukuoka, down in Kyushu, south part of Japan. I just saw a hand go up for Fukuoka. All right.
Fukuoka. Yay!
And that's the Hakata ramen, and especially connected with a tonkotsu broth. And what I love, one thing I love is that so tonkotsu broth is a broth where the pig bones have been like simmered extra long or something, and they develop this, I don't even know what the English term is for it, but it's like a...
Collagen.
Yeah, collagen. It becomes a milkiness or like a gelatinous a little bit or something. Yeah. And so what I love, though, is the legend of that is that it was an accident, that the guy, like a guy at some ramen shop let it boil too long and came back and was like, wow, this is great. Whereas the complete opposite story is true of the Sapporo ramen, the miso ramen from the north, where you can we know the actual store where the miso ramen was invented. It's a place called Ajino Sanpei, and the guy, I forget the exact details. Do you know the basically he wanted to make something that would go well with pork or something like that, and so he tried this miso and he experimented over 3 weeks, and it was a very methodical kind of thing. And somehow those stories also, as George was saying, ramen gets used as a tourism thing. They sort of are reflective of the areas a little bit, like Fukuoka being, Hakata being more rough and tumble, or, you know, and Sapporo being more bland, something like that.
Yeah, and in Sapporo's case, it's really cold up there, so people always say, in cold places, you need saltier food, and that's why Sapporo's miso ramen is so salty, and it gets the people through their cold times. And there's all these kind of stories that surround each regional ramen and why that ramen is popular in that area and so on. But That's really an 80s phenomenon, I think. And late 70s and 80s when people started really demanding kind of an extra entertainment value out of their ramen consumption. So until then, it was just something you get at the local shop. It fills you up. It's cheap. And it gives you stamina to carry on with your work. From the 80s on, it becomes targeted more to youth culture. It's popular among the younger generation, and they have more disposable income, so they have more leeway in how they can entertain themselves. And so in the 80s, it really becomes part of youth entertainment, this regional ramen boom, and how people would travel long distances. And then the admiration of ramen really took off, so you have long magazine articles, comic books, all kinds of all kinds of media productions related to the appreciation of ramen rather than just the selling of ramen itself. So
yeah, this is just one ramen guidebook, like he's talking about. I mean, so I was in this is from Kyoto and Osaka area, and it just has, you know, like a picture of the top of the bowl and then the description of what's special about it, different recommended. And there's like dozens of magazines in every bookstore exactly like this.
I wanted to point out, we're going to move forward, but while we're still talking about these regionals, I was able to get permission from Tatsuo Mori, who is the publisher at Japan Up. And they actually did a whole issue on ramen based in L.A. He's based in L.A., and if you travel down there, it's a free magazine, pick it up, and it's a great guide to Japanese food. It's called Japan Up, Japanese Cuisine and Trends. I actually begged him to give us extra copies so I could give to you, and they were completely out, but he was really kind and let me reproduce the regional ramen page, which each of you should have. We have extra copies if you want to bring some to your friends, and I encourage you to take that with you and memorize them. Learn it, but also we have a glossary so that when you go to a good ramen shop, then you can kind of get a sense of what's being served to you. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the flavors regionally. We get on to that, and I think, well, we only have about 7 minutes left, so I'll leave you to read more about the actual regions. So much to talk about. But can you talk a little bit, now let's expand out, because I know that you are, I'm totally fascinated with intersections with the Latino community and how many of these packages you'll notice if you looked are bilingual. And I was talking to Harold Lee, who's been in specialty Asian produce marketing for about 33 years, and he definitely confirmed also that it is also one of the biggest groups now eating it. And they like the cilantro, the spicy flavor, and shrimp is also very popular with the Latino. And I know you have some thoughts on Africa and South America.
Yeah, and Southeast Asia. From the little I've read about what Nissin's strategy is for the future, it's basically to try to go into third world markets and expand as much as possible. And it makes a lot of sense, but it also reminds me of the fact that how U.S. wheat flour going into Japan initially kind of served the same purpose, to try to gain as much market share in Japan as possible. And it ended up displacing a lot of traditional Japanese dietary habits, like rice consumption dropped significantly in the late 50s and 60s as a result of all the bread and noodles and things like that coming in that replaced the rice. So my understanding is basically that instant ramen is probably going to have a similar role in Latin America, Southeast Asia, and Africa that American wheat flour did in Japan in terms of displacing traditional dietary practices and just shifting towards greater convenience, mass production, and more less nutritious, but sold as something that is nutritious and healthy. And one interesting thing is that it always takes the form of the local flavors. So like T was saying, it's cilantro, curry noodles, smoodles, I think.
Noodles.
And stuff, so.
Which is great if you go to India, and they have it in Canada too. It's thicker, and because people are eating with their hands, it's more of a gravy than a broth. And actually, we didn't mention that. Why was chicken the first, you know, ingredient as far as knowing that he knew that it would be eaten across lots of dietary restrictions, and so chicken was the international flavor.
He claims that was a lucky thing,
mm-hmm.
that he was glad that he chose chicken.
Oh, really? It was accidental.
But actually, he claims he chose it because his son liked chicken broth.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And when I was reading a little bit about the process of inventing it, he had tried, like, frog soup or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, well.
Oh, you want to take a little diversion into that? That's an interesting story, actually.
Well, it's just, so around 10 years before he started with the ramen and built the shack, even before that, during World War II, one of his businesses, he was accused of selling government property illegally on a black market, and he was put in jail by the Japanese military police and tortured, he claims, for, I believe, around 90 days. And he had been a wealthy man, and in this terrible, terrible prison, a Japanese military prison, where people were, literally stabbed and had their, genitals mutilated and all kinds of terrible things. He's forced to eat really dirty food, off dirty plates, filth, and he has this almost spiritual realization. So first he doesn't want to eat it. He's like, I'm not going to eat that. And he sees the other people, how they need to eat, and eventually he comes to need to eat, and he sees the role of food in the world and in his life. And after the war, his first foray into the food world was he created an institute, and he tried to make a cheap food product for hospitals. So this is still, people are still dying of hunger in Japan 2 or 3 years after the war. And so he is thinking about ingredients one night when he hears this frog croaking in the backyard. He gets the frog, puts it in a pressure cooker, and it explodes all over the house. And his wife gets really pissed at him.
Is that why there's a shack in the backyard?
In his book though, he's like, but it tasted sort of good. So I don't think it was a frog, but that led to a product for hospitals, and that was his first food product. He later had a company that made salt, evaporating salt off the seashore, and then eventually he got into the noodles after losing everything from that bank.
So I do want to acknowledge that instant food isn't necessarily the best thing for us to be eating, but I just wanted us still to talk about and celebrate its history and its culture and acknowledge that everything in moderation, right? Did you have anything to say about maybe where we are now in the 90s and the aughts and with ramen and where it's heading?
Well, I personally lost an internal organ thanks to ramen.
Right.
So my story... The way that I got back into ramen was I was first kicked out of a sushi bar in Coal Valley. This is the story in my book. And by a sort of strict sushi chef that I had a relationship with, I thought. And I was at another sushi bar, and this guy next to me starts telling me about this legendary ramen shop in Tokyo called Ramen Jiro. And he sort of makes it sound like if you go there, you can find out if you're a man. Kind of like what he's saying, you know? And it's just like, and the more he said about it, the more I was like, this is so great. Like, there's like code words for ordering, and the only thing on the menu is small and large. And as a novice, there's all this stuff on the web how you're not even supposed to, as a novice, even think about a large. And basically, I went there, and I was kind of shivering after I finished. And when I got back to San Francisco, I had a pain in my side in the middle of the night, and I went to the hospital, and the guy was like, did you eat anything, like, this has, like, a layer of lard, like this, on top of the ramen. He's like, did you eat anything really fatty recently? I was like, yeah. And he's like, because your gallbladder is infected, and we're going to have to take it out. And then I called this friend about it, and I was like, I called him from the hospital, like, I just had my gallbladder taken out. He's like, oh, yeah, that happens to all my friends.
So
it's not just instant ramen. Although there are a lot of new ramen. We were talking about this. So maybe George can cover this. There have been a lot of new wave ramen that are not new instant ramen that are not fried that are supposedly healthier for you.
Mm-hmm.
And just old Sadaharu, the home run king of Japan. He also got stomach cancer from eating too much ramen. So
really?
It's not something.
Harold was saying that there certainly are developments with. Not tried ramens, like steamed, and but the fact is no one eats ramen for health reasons. It's definitely about convenience, and so convenience will always rule when it comes to ramen, whether it's going into a shop for a quick meal or whether it's microwaving it at the office. So Any last thoughts before we move to Q&A?
There is a book explaining the health benefits of ramen that I found in Japan. It says it prevents senility. You know, there's a whole book about it. Anyway, sorry.
Okay.
And Momofuku wrote a book called How to Live to 100. Mm. He died at 96, but... But he always claimed that he ate a bowl of instant chicken ramen, his original invention is also there, every day for lunch, and that that was his secret to health.
Is that the one with the dimple in it?
Oh, yeah. So this is literally the package, essentially the same package that they've been selling for 50 years. The 50th anniversary was last year. And... Nichin has also a very interesting corporate culture. The brand managers of the various products are forced to really fight it out for resources in the company, and it leads to them coming up with really crazy ideas. So the brand manager, the sales of this, it's been out for 50 years almost by this point. The sales are kind of tailing off as all these other newfangled ones come in. He just goes out and frantically just observes people eating this. And he notices that it's a lot of old men and that they crack an egg on it and they get really pissed when the egg doesn't just sit there and like coagulate so that it looks like a sunny side up, or I'm not really into eggs, so I don't know what you call it, but like so that,
yeah,
that nice
sunny side up.
Yeah, sunny side up egg. And so he develops what he calls the egg pocket. So this is a cylindrical disc. It's a little well in there so that when the egg goes in, it will stay in place. Sales just go crazy. So then this has been the next couple of years later. This is what's called the W pocket. The W sounds like double, So the letter W is often used to mean double. So the W pocket. Is there's a pocket, and then there's a pocket for the egg white, and then there's a little pocket for the yolk, so it's like a double pocket. So this one is the ultimate in ramen technology.
And the original package from 50 years ago actually said build strong bodies and very nutritious, and it was written in English because the alphabet was supposed to be more appealing visually, so they changed that 10 years later. But anyway,
called it chicken ramen, C-H-I-K-I-N. Maybe he didn't care. Know how to spell chicken? I don't know.
So coming full circle. Thank you so much. But we're gonna let's go ahead and give him a hand now. Isn't that great? Thank you. And this is your opportunity to ask questions. We had a roving mic, but it doesn't work. And so please, I will point you out, and then just make sure to project so everyone in the room can hear. Amy, of course.
Question. I was in Hawaii in December, and there are a lot of these regional ramen shops that specialize in one style versus another style. And the one that really specialized in the Hakata style talked endlessly about the collagen and that it would prevent wrinkles. They had this whole thing about how women should come and drink it, and it'll prevent wrinkles and collagen. You know, they put it in face cream and that kind of thing. But I just thought it was wacky, and I wasn't sure if that was like a Japanese thing or whether this Hawaiian shop is promoting this idea, but you do get that texture, that almost sticky kind of texture of breaking down of the bones, which is collagen, but the idea that somehow if you ingest it that you're going to be wrinkle-free, have you heard of this before, and where does this come from?
Yeah, absolutely. I think like, I don't know, 8 years ago or so, there was this big collagen boom, so it was like anything you can find with collagen in it is good for you, and ramen happened to be one of these things, so it was in that book with all the health benefits of ramen, actually.
They
call
collagen.
Yeah.
There's a question here first. Is there a hand here? Yes.
I'd like to know why you got kicked out of the famous sushi bar.
I think there's a book that explains the whole story.
You can ask him afterwards.
But the short thing is, you know, there's some sushi bars where it's almost like entering a, you know, like a martial arts academy where, you know, you're sort of, there's levels, you know, and I had gone a couple of levels and I reached a point where I was tested and failed.
Oh,
We made up, though, and I just went to go see them the other day to bring them the book, and we had a nice, we've had a lot of, everything's good now, so.
Yes?
I noticed that you have these set up kind of regionally, so I was wondering if you might talk about sort of the regional differences of the ramen, but not so much the history, but just sort of the distinct differences, and then I'd be really interested in knowing what your favorite ones are.
I don't know a lot about all the different regions. The couple that I do know, this one is a brand called Indomie, and when it's made in Indonesia, and when I was just starting to get into ramen, when I started praying to the inventor of instant ramen, like weird ramen things start happening in my life without like just me knowing, and one was this. I'm a journalist, and a journalist I know from Chicago just suddenly calls me up, and he's like, Andy, I know you live in Japan. Maybe you're into instant ramen. And if you are, there's this brand called Indomie. He goes, this brand has five flavor packets. Like, this is not ramen. This is theater. So this one, though, there's no soup. You boil the noodles. Then throw out the boiled water, and then mix it with this, you know, do this theatrical mixing of all the things. So it's really fun and it's really good. The other one that I have some connection to, other than the Japanese ones, is the Korean ones, which tend to be really spicy. And even is that a Korean one right there?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Quite a few.
Yeah. The character for spicy is on
this one?
Is on it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is Korea, right?
That's the Korean area. the reason that is. When my book came out, or shortly before, Arthur Golden, the author of Memoirs of a Geisha, wrote me an email like, hey, I really love your book. By the way, I'm really into instant ramen. And I was like, really? And he's like, yeah, do you have any recommendations? So I recommended Indomie, and I said, you know, you can get it on Amazon. And he wrote back, he's like, yeah, I know. And then he tried it, I guess, and he didn't like it as much as the Korean one. He said he really loved the Korean ones. And so I've been dying to taste those Korean ones, so.
Oh, you haven't had them?
I haven't had them, but,
take one.
But because they're recommended to me by Arthur Golden, I feel like I would like to try one. Maybe
I would, I can, the Southeast Asians ones, some of them are sort of smaller, serving size, I've noticed. I mean, just literally the noodles are a smaller packet, and they tend to be more sour, some of them, and there's with tamarind in them. And just so you know, these are all available in the U.S., and we got them at three major stores, Nijiya in Japantown, Kukje in Daly City, the Korean store, and Numewa on Clement Street. So if you see it here, that's where. I just want to point out something that's kind of emergent is sort of stick ramen. Making it look, you know, a little bit more like nicer noodles. It tends to be two servings. I bet you there are people who eat both. But, and they're a little, and they're becoming a little bit more expensive. This one is one that's hard to find. Nijiya. It's actually regional. It's upside down. I can't see. No,
oh, yeah,
was
yeah,
it?
Yeah. You're right.
Yes, it is. Okay, sorry. So, and these are by region, so what you look for are the little region popping out. It's not translated, so you'd have to maybe bring your own map. But these are actually pretty good quality. And we're getting into the $5 range here. So most of these are from 90 cents to $5 per packet. So we're not talking the, you know, 10 cents top ramen at the Costco necessarily. And Korean ones tend to be spicy. Tend to be a little heartier, too. But really interesting variations. I don't know if you wanted to say anything about it.
Yeah, for me, just the favorite. My favorite is the Korean one. I don't know why, but it's more digestible for me anyway. But the thing I want to say about this is Charumera. This has a picture of the pushcart guy who is like a legendary cartoonish figure now because he's disappeared in real life except for a few cities where they're still celebrated. But he's holding this horn, which was called a charumera, and was basically a big part of the roaming ramen vendor's shtick. And he would basically announce to the local residents that he had arrived in his nightly spot with his horn. So I heard somewhere that in Southeast Asia you still see some places with
you hear the knock knock too.
Or the horn. But this is obsolete in Japan now, so it's become like a historical image or something. But, yeah.
Another question? Yeah. It is. It's about a ramen shop. You can get it. You can definitely get it subtitle. We're seeing. Well, great. Great film.
There's a new movie now called Ramen Girl.
Someone said someone said I didn't like it.
It went straight to DVD. but it's got Brittany Murphy is the lead in it, and it is an American movie even though it's filmed in Japan. And there's a cameo by the guy from Tampopo. The plot is really bad. Like it's the plot development is bad, and I'm not sure. Maybe people in a lot of the country don't know what ramen is, so maybe that's why the movie couldn't have been released generally. But as someone who like tracks the word ramen in Twitter and things like that, it has gotten a lot of buzz. But the setup is that basically there's this ramen owner and his son has deserted him. And he has a friend whose son is about to take over his shop. And so he gets her, Brittany Murphy, who happens to be in Japan and upset and looking for spiritual guidance, to be his like apprentice. And then it's this fight. And in order to succeed as the new master, this guy from Tampopo has to approve your ramen, and so he tastes it, and if he says okay, then you can go. So it's that's the story. It's which one is going to be approved by the master?
Huh. In the back, first there is a question. Did you have in the white shirt? Yes.
Oh, actually, yeah, she stole my question.
Oh, okay. then there was one over here. There was one over here.
The funeral. I found out that he died. He died on January 5th, 2007. And it was weird. Like, I had already had this whole adventure with him, with my love life, and I would talk about it. Nobody knew that maybe George, who he was. And then suddenly there was this article in the New York Times called Appreciation Mr. Noodle. Did anybody see that by any chance? A couple of people. This was the most emailed article for like 3 or 4 days on the Times website. And so suddenly, a lot of people know who he is. They're just people are like fascinated to find out there's this guy. Anyway, a few weeks later, I track his name on Google Alerts and things like this. I got this notice that the funeral was going to be held at Osaka Dome, which is a baseball stadium. And I decided, of course, that I'm going to go. And I had to talk my way in. And I talked my way in. Weird coincidence. I happened to have had an article in the New York Times the day before, and I had it with me. And when I went to the gate, they thought I was the one who wrote the Appreciation Mr. Noodle. And so I did not disabuse them of that, you know, whatever the phrase is of that. I didn't correct her. So I go in. It's this dark tunnel, you know, like, I emerge in, like, foul territory on the third base side. It's completely dark because Osaka Dome is a dome stadium, and all the lights are out. There's 7,000 people in there by this point. Gradually, my eyes start to adjust, the pupils dilate, whatever, and I notice there's these, like, twinkling stars in the bleachers. And then I see on the stadium monitors, there's these galaxies spinning around, huge galaxies spinning around, and I'm like, why is it? It's like outer space. And then, up on the screen, there's all these like 30 monks chanting, and they start out by chanting like normal Buddhist chants, which is a sort of nonsense, like, it's like this joke. But after a while, I start to realize it's morphed into real Japanese that is essentially, if it were English, it would be like, invented instant ramen. hand cup noodles. This whole, basically a bio in chant. And then his son, who's now the CEO of Nissin, we call it Nissin is the English way, or Nishin is the Japanese way to pronounce the company. The son gets up and makes a speech, and he says, "In 1910, my father came to the world with Halley's Comet, and now we're going to send him back." So that was why it was out of space. The whole theme of the funeral was to send him back where he came from, to the heavens. Also, everybody at the funeral got a goodie bag, which included this 5-pack of chicken ramen. It was just the regular egg pocket. It wasn't double yet at that time. This Eco Cup cup noodle, which I use as a kind of God box. When I have a problem, I just write it. I write it on a piece of paper and put it in there and ask Momofuku Ando to take care of it for me. And also this book. So you may have heard there's the Nietzsche had Thus Spake Zarathustra. This is a collection of Ando's famous sayings called Thus Spake Momofuku that we all got too. And actually, I run a website called ramenadvice.com. And if you go to ramenadvice.com, I'll answer any like Dear Abby style question based on his wisdom from this book.
Yes.
Where do you see ramen going, maybe in the United States market in the next 5-10 years?
From what I see in New York, which is where I live, it's just getting bigger and bigger. So, you know, there's big lines outside of what's that?
Ifudo,
yeah, Ifudo, and it seems to be getting more and more popular. There was a food review recently, so I think it's going to grow, but that's just a guess. I'm not sure.
You're talking about ramen shops.
Ramen shops, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not talking about instant ramen. I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Just as a number, last year, the instant ramen sales worldwide broke through 100 billion. So 100 billion servings of instant ramen consumed in the world.
It's 10 billion annually, I think the last and most recent.
And the average Japanese eats 39 servings of instant ramen per year.
I don't remember, but you know, the biggest producers now are not in Japan. Indonesia, I believe, is now the biggest producer. China is probably closer now, bigger.
Developing world.
Yeah.
Is going to see about more ramen. Yes?
With the added popularity here in the United States with the ramen shops, do you see them kind of following some of these regional specialties on their menus? And if so, is there one that seems to be kind of an emerging powerhouse, something that you find more commonly in the ramen shops?
I think Ifudo, which is... Ifudo is Hakata ramen.
At least so.
Yeah. Mainly the Hakata, the tonkotsu variation with the gelatinous soup is taken off more because that was the one that became popular among youth in Japan in the 80s, so that's spread over more. And in Japan itself, they're turning more towards like a healthier fish broth style of ramen, so eventually that may come over here, but I don't know. I don't like that stuff so much. For me personally, I like the tonkotsu style, and I see how that kind of fits into American noodle diet. So I could see that growing. And I think it's the Hakata style that's going to keep spreading in the U.S. more.
A little off the question, but this guy, his name is Ishigami, and he has made a living for himself as a ramen critic. So there's like film critic, you know, he's ramen critic. In fact, every one of these books, these ramen discovery legend books, ends with one of his essays. And they're titled like, you know, scallions, like he'll do a whole essay on, or like pork, you know. And so this is a magazine, a food magazine that devoted almost all of itself to ramen one issue. And he just went around and looked at some new way of ramens that he really liked. This one, I really love it. It's a Chinese-based ramen, but it has truffles on top. And so you see these weird ones, like just... As George is saying, there's like fish ones now. There's a lobster one with foie gras that goes for $100 in New Yokohama. It's all kinds of crazy stuff now. And this part of this is because ramen is relatively new. You know, sushi has, you know, hundreds of years history. Even something like tempura, which supposedly came from the Portuguese, hundreds of years. In Ramen Discovery Legend, one of the grand masters says to him, you know, ramen has no history. There is no manual. That's why it can help you understand yourself.
Eric.
I listened to the very beginning, so excuse me if you already addressed this. I'm curious about how the Chinese view the Japanese taking their food, and then especially in the post-war period when the Chinese-Japanese relations were strained, did they have their own name for ramen? Did they adopt instant ramen? Did they make it themselves? Did they use Japanese ramen?
I'm not sure about instant, but I know that ramen is sold as Japanese in China, and in Shanghai it's a huge boom right now apparently. There's a lot of Japanese ramen shops spreading, and the origin, the fact that it comes from China originally has almost no kind of, it's not really made a big deal about over there for some reason.
And that was true, as far as you know, in the post-war period, there wasn't a, we don't eat ramen because that's so
imperialist. Oh no, I think it's very recent, the ramen coming into China, and the instant version was not labeled as Japanese or not really associated.
So if you're in the Cultural Revolution, you wouldn't be eating ramen.
No, right. No. Or if they did, they didn't think of it as ramen. It was some...
Yes, back then.
I'd have to say 1994, because that's when the Ramen Museum was built. But if you want to go to books and articles, it was developing already in the 80s when people were saying, you know, there's some kind of national spiritual essence contained in this dish. And you can find that from, like, 83, 84 on. But the museum's 94, and that's when you have, you know, documentaries and all kinds of television programs devoted to celebrating the Japanese-ness of ramen at that point. So.
I don't think it's secret.
Another question? Yes.
So the 92 is when the Japanese economy went down, and the bubble economy burst, and that was really associated. Then all these magazines started at that time saying, okay, ramen cheap, good. Like there's gonna be a ramen boom. The economy never came up. You know, and ramen stayed at the top sort of for that, you know, period too. And so the Yokohama Ramen Museum gets built. I just recently counted, I think it was something like 37 ramen theme parks all around Japan. Like, Japan is the land now of food theme parks. There's an issue in here where his company decides to build a ramen theme park, and there's so many of them that they have to just, the big drama is how are we going to distinguish our ramen theme park from all the other ramen theme parks, you know? Like, everybody's doing a ramen theme park.
What happens at a ramen theme park?
Well, theme park is a term for, essentially, it's a glorified food. Imagine the ferry building, but all the places serve ramen. And they're each kind of like an outlet for a ramen shop from somewhere around the country. So there's a gyoza one that's called Gyoza Stadium. In a video game mall, there's a few of those. There's Tokyo Bread Street, which is because there's Yokohama Curry Theme Park. So I could go on and on.
Yes.
This question came up 3 years ago on another Asia Society related panel, and I said there's no good ramen shops in San Francisco that I would condone, and I unfortunately still feel that way. There are some great shops though, not too far away. There's Santa in San Mateo. There's also my favorite is Halu, the place in I think it's technically Santa Clara. It's called Ramen Halu, H-A-L-U, and these are places where there's really fanatic about it. Like the guy simmers the broth for like, you know, days and things like that, or at least many, many hours, and they're very, very serious. There's a few places in the city. There's a place, Katanaya. It's okay. It's still greasy, whatever. Does anyone have any favorite that they want to scream out that I'm wrong?
What do you think of Suzu?
Suzu, okay. Not crazy,
okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Oyaji, well, the Oyaji guy is just a story in himself. Oyaji is a restaurant on Clement at 32nd. Actually, we just went there the other night, and some people down the counter from us were having ramen. Uh, the really most notable thing about the place is that the owner tends to drink a lot and then hit on the female customers in a way that is, believe it or not, sort of charming. But, you know, they, and it's good, it's okay, but they're not, you know, they're not, Oyaji serves sushi, they serve lots of other stuff, and I love it. I mean, I love going there. I think their cooked dishes especially are really fantastic. But they're not specializing in ramen, and so it's not super distinctive. I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing he uses commercial broth. That's sort of like, in this book, like, that would be the ultimate, you use commercial broth, okay. Yeah. And maybe even commercial noodles probably, too. You know, he's not making that stuff handmade and
wonderful. George, do you have any in New York you'd recommend?
Yeah, Ippudo is good. Ippudo is like a Hakata-based one that is in the Ramen Museum, too, and has branched out to the U.S. now. Setagaya in New York is not bad. It's a shio ramen, salt ramen place. But generally speaking, it's not that impressive, I think.
L.A. has some good ramen places, very good ramen places, too.
Yeah, Chablia is not bad in L.A.
Are there some
San Diego? San Diego has this one place. It's a regular Japanese restaurant that serves ramen from, like, 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. And, and, you know, it's a great place to go at that time if you want ramen. And it's good ramen, actually. The guy makes it himself. The soup and stuff. It's called, what's the name? Tajima, yeah.
One more question. Yes,
so you named a few places that obviously haven't served as your favorite bowl, but so what do you look for when it's like that in the one?
For me, it's this place in Japan that the first time I had it, it was like, this is all right. And then I went home, I was like, I want that again. And then it kind of keeps grabbing back at you. It's not the one that really, this is delicious the first time you have it, because that's the one with too much MSG, and it's not, it's something that keeps bringing you back very subtly, though, for me, that's the one. And in Japan, it's Ramen Ichiban, it's on Kannan Street.
Describe it to you, like, I want to know,
it's this big ramen chef who, like, keeps you waiting in line for 2 hours. Once you sit down, he doesn't even ask you for your order for, like, 10 minutes, and you know, he's just in his own world. It's him and his soup, and that's it, basically. And you're lucky to partake in that relationship of him and his soup, basically. You know, that's kind of the way it is.
Yeah, I think it's almost not about the ramen, you know. It's this whole thing around it. It's a very similar thing at Ramenjiro, the place where I lost my gallbladder. One of the things I love about that place is, so there's small, and there's large. And then there's this thing that is not even on the menu, secret, called, what's it called, menmashi. And menmashi means, so basically, like, the large is larger than anything you could imagine. And then what happens with menmashi is, so actually my friend, I've never seen this, but my friend saw it once, and he said, this guy comes and he looks like a sumo wrestler, you know, and he sits down and he says, the menmashi, and the whole place goes quiet. It's like a saloon, you know, where, like, the bad guy walks in, like, you know, everyone's quiet. This guy gets the central seat in front of the guy, you know, and then he gets a large with a double pork, and then first, once he's done with the noodles, so there's still broth, the owner puts in another 50% additional noodle into that bowl. And the thing is, you can't not finish. Like if you don't finish, it's a big shame. So you don't. If you're not gonna, you know, finish it, you're not gonna ask for this menmashi. But when he finishes, it's like he's a hero. You know, it's like, so there's something around this culture. You know, and it's weird. Like, I asked people online. I went almost as a journalist the first time, and I asked people. It's right near Keio University. And so there's a lot of Keio students in there. Keio is almost like an Ivy League university equivalent of one. And they'll have these towels strapped around their their necks, because it's hot. They're gonna be wiping off the soup and the sweat, you know, as they're trying to finish the bowl. They come with these towels, and you know, I would ask other people online, you know, normal looking people, like, you know, are you excited that they'd be like, what are you talking about? You know, it's just having ramen. And I talk to them, and like, yes, I can't wait to eat the large, you know. So there's something about the personality, I think, of, you know, there probably are some people who are just, you know, like a nice bowl of ramen, and then, you know, others. So anyway.
Sorry, I didn't answer it.
Sorry, yeah.
But,
yeah, no, when you taste it.
Maybe you can pick them afterwards. I'm afraid we're going to have to close. I know there's one more questions, but Andy and George will be lingering for a few minutes, so please come up if you have individual questions. I just want to give them, I'm going to give them a round of applause for us, and I have some notes for you. I think we all learned a tremendous amount tonight from what seems like a simple, humble noodle. I want to direct, we have a little raffle, a fun raffle. So if you open up your program, there was an evaluation sheet.